Hello, welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. I'll be reading local news from the Waterloo Cedar Falls and Northeast Iowa area. The first article is headlined, Iowa Remains a Virus Hotspot. Des Moines. Iowa remains in the red zone for spread of the coronavirus, according to the latest report from the White House. Published Tuesday by the New York Times, the White House report also shows 61 Iowa counties are in red or yellow zones that indicate heightened virus activity. That number is up from 47 counties in the report 2 weeks ago. The federal government has dispatched 14 staff workers to Iowa to assist with medical activities. On a conference call Tuesday with governors, White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx listed Iowa as one of 13 states the task force is working with and encouraged those states to increase mitigation efforts now, according to a CNN report on the call. Because if we wait until increased hospitalizations, it is really way too late, Birx told governors on the call. Because what we are experiencing now is really different than March and April. It's very different from the outbreaks of May that were typically contained. This widespread community spread is in the younger age group, both rural and urban areas. So by the time you see it, up to 80% to 90% of your counties already have more than 10% of cases that are positive. Statewide, Iowa's coronavirus cases have surged back to near the state's first peak in early May, according to state public health data. Virus-related deaths and hospitalizations also have been climbing, albeit more gradually. The White House Task Force categorizes areas with new cases above 100 per 100,000 population and a positive test share above 10% as red zones, according to the report. Areas with cases between 10 and 100 per 100,000 population and a positive test share between 5% and 10% are classified as yellow zones. The report classified 8 Iowa counties as red zones: Dubuque, Emmett, Franklin, Hardin, Lyon, Marshall, Montgomery, and Wapello. The report listed Dubuque, Marshalltown, and Ottumwa as red zone communities. In red zones, the White House recommends bars and gyms be closed, restaurants limited to strict social distancing, and face masks be required inside all businesses. None of those mitigation strategies are in place in Iowa. Bars, gyms, and restaurants are allowed to operate at full capacity, and while Governor Kim Reynolds has encouraged Iowans to wear masks when social distancing is not possible, she has not required them. The state public health department and governor's office did not immediately respond to questions about the task force's recommendations or the federal workers that reportedly were sent to Iowa. According to state public health data, Iowa's positive test share has been below 10% for most days since late May. As of Wednesday afternoon, more than 43,000 Iowans have contracted the virus and 845 Iowans have died of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, since the pandemic first arrived here in late March. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported 458 new cases on Wednesday and 3 new deaths. Blackhawk County reported 3,524 total cases as of Wednesday, up 11 from the previous day, while deaths remain unchanged at 62. Our next article is headlined, COVID testing expands at Tyson. Tyson's Food will launch weekly coronavirus testing of workers after outbreaks sickened thousands of employees and idled production at several meat plants this spring. The company also will hire nearly 200 nurses and administrative support personnel to bolster Tyson's 400-person health services team. The nurses will conduct the on-site tests and assist with case management, coordinating treatment for employees who contract the disease. Tyson also will create a chief medical officer position at the corporate level. Four company representatives shared details of the new monitoring initiative during a Zoom meeting Wednesday. "This is a very proactive way for us to do our best to stay ahead of this virus rather than what we've experienced in the recent past," Hector Gonzalez, Tyson's Senior Vice President for Human Resources, said. Early in the pandemic, meatpackers nationwide struggled to contain the virus in plants where workers toil side by side on production lines and often share crowded locker rooms, cafeterias, and rides to work. Tyson has tested around 40,000 workers, or nearly one-third of its workforce. Of its 122,000 employees, less than 1%, or about 1,200, are active COVID-19 cases, according to the company. The company conducted mass testing at several plants where large-scale outbreaks occurred. That included in Waterloo, where Tyson's pork processing facility closed April 22nd, amid an outbreak that infected more than 1,000 workers. Its flagship beef plant in Dakota City, Nebraska, just across the border from Sioux City, shut down in early May after nearly 790 of the 4,500 workers tested positive for the virus. Tyson temporarily idled several other plants, including pork facilities in Storm Lake, Columbus Junction, Perry, and Madison, Nebraska, after hundreds of workers were infected. The company now will test thousands of workers each week across all of its 140 facilities. "That will be ongoing all the time," said Scott Brooks, Senior Vice President who leads the company's testing efforts. "As we expand this, we're going to be touching even those facilities where we don't know if we have any cases," he said. "So it's going to be a significant expansion." Workers with no symptoms may be tested through an algorithm-based process based on scientific data. The number tested each week will be adjusted based on factors such as the number of cases involving plant workers and in the community. Other information also will factor in, said Dr. Daniel Castillo, Chief Medical Officer for Matrix Medical, a private clinic services company Tyson retained to conduct on-site screenings. "There are some people, because of the nature of their work, who might interact more with others, so that data would trigger that algorithm to identify those folks to be tested perhaps more often," Castillo said. Mark Peroni, International President of the United Food and Commercial Workers, the largest union representing Tyson hourly workers, urged other industry employers to follow Tyson's lead and take immediate action to expand COVID monitoring as we work to flatten the curve. "Together, we will continue to look for new and better ways to protect the health and safety of the brave frontline workers who are so important to the nation's food production system," Peroni said in a news release from Tyson. Tyson officials had already expanded monitoring and increased health staff since the pandemic struck. Workers have their temperatures taken daily by infrared scanners at plant entrances and are required to wear facial coverings. More than 500 social distance monitors have been installed in plants to track social distancing efforts and ensure personal protective equipment is worn properly. Workers who test positive receive paid leave and may return to work only after they meet criteria established by Tyson and the Centers for Disease Control. Waterloo sees plans for park and 11th Street bridges. By Tim Jameson of the Courier from Waterloo. Plans to replace two Cedar River bridges are pitting a desire for flood improvements against negative impacts on nearby properties. Engineering Consultants Monday unveiled preliminary design options to replace the deteriorating Park Avenue and 11th Street bridges. The city received a $12.5 million federal grant to pay for the project, which has an overall estimated cost of $20 million to $25 million. Stanley Consultants Incorporated of Des Moines was hired under a $505,000 contract last fall to handle preliminary design. City officials had hoped to raise both bridges enough to eliminate the need to install temporary gates and to keep them open to traffic when the Cedar River reaches a severe flood stage. Ideally, we would be able to eliminate those gates so the bridge could remain open, said Tom Bauer, project manager for Stanley Consultants. But that does create some potential negatives that we don't like so much. Bauer noted raising the Park Avenue bridge enough to remove the floodgates would prevent a direct pedestrian connection to the River Loop Amphitheater and shut the Cedar Street intersection and eliminate most driveway accesses between the river and Sycamore Street. Consultants are instead recommending the bridge only be raised 4 feet, which would provide headroom for the bicycle trail running underneath and prevent cutting off all but one driveway access. However, the firm is recommending the 11th Street Bridge be elevated enough to eliminate the floodgates. The move would create a retaining wall cutting off some access to a bar and restaurant on the east side of the river and a business on the west side of the river. It's a win for some people and a loss for others in that regard, said City Engineer Jamie Knutson. The Park Avenue Bridge, built in 1938, and the 11th Street Bridge, built in 1953, were both four-lane crossings, although the Park Avenue span was reduced to 2 lanes of traffic several years ago based on structural concerns. Stanley Consultants, in cooperation with city staff, have recommended the replacement bridges both have 2 lanes of vehicular traffic. The Park Avenue Bridge would have bicycle lanes, sidewalks, and scenic overlooks on both sides. The 11th Street Bridge would have a bicycle lane, sidewalk, and overlooks only on the downstream side. Another key decision discussed during a City Council work session was whether to have a barrier between the vehicle lanes and the bicycle trails on the Park Avenue Bridge. Councilman Pat Morrissey said he believes that barrier was needed. But Knutson noted including the barrier would be a problem with some organizations' desires to close the bridge and fill it with vendors and visitors during major downtown events. The federal grant requires the city to replace both bridges with similar designs and have a bid letting by September 2021. The consultants hope to have a final design determined by next spring following a public information meeting. Both bridges could be replaced at one time in 2022, but the city could choose to replace one bridge in 2023. Stanley Consultants has a website set up for the project, waterloobridgesproject.com, where residents can learn more about the history of the bridges, vote on design themes, and see renderings of the design elements. Regents okay cuts to universities' presidential pay. In lopping over $65 million from Iowa's public universities in fiscal 2021 to help account for losses from COVID-19, state funding cuts, and enrollment declines, the State Board of Regents on Wednesday praised campus administrators for making sacrifices. Acting to take account of the losses, which projected a $53 million drop in tuition income alone, Regents approved pared-down general operating fund budgets of nearly $728 million for the University of Iowa, $630 million for Iowa State University, and $170 million for the University of Northern Iowa. That doesn't include the UI hospitals and clinics. Regents praised the campus leaders for sharing in the losses by cutting their compensation. I have been personally very impressed by our institutional leadership agreeing to take pay reductions to help with the economic challenges our schools are facing, said Board President Mike Richards. The universities, which have announced plans to return students to campus this fall with a combination of in-person and online courses, nonetheless face more financial uncertainties as the pandemic persists. The board approved the following compensation changes for the presidents of its universities. University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld will take a 50% cut to his $590,000 base pay for the rest of the budget year, a one-time savings of $270,416. Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein will take a one-year 10% cut to her $590,000 base pay, amounting to $59,000. And University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook will shave $42,110 from his $357,110 base pay through the end of the budget year, while also cutting his annual deferred compensation payments from $100,000 to $50,000 through June 30, 2020. Harreld and Winterstein also have deferred compensation plans scheduled through 2023, paying out $2.33 million to Harreld and more than $1 million to Winterstein. They have not announced making changes to those plans. The board also Wednesday agreed to establish a new deferred compensation plan for its executive director, Mark Braun. That makes annual contributions of $145,000 through June 30, 2022. Richards noted Braun voluntarily took a 16.5% pay cut. Administrators across the campus's athletics departments also have taken pay cuts, including high-profile football, basketball, and wrestling coaches Kirk Herons, Fran McCaffrey, Lisa Bluter, and Tom Brands at the UI. Budget reductions have translated to faculty and staff furloughs, pay cuts, lost raises, and hiring freezes across the campuses. They've halted construction and consolidated programs. Our next article says Grassley calls latest relief package reasonable response to COVID-19 hardship. Disagreement over the continuation of a $600 a week federal supplemental unemployment benefit is likely to be the biggest hurdle to the next phase of coronavirus relief, Senator Chuck Grassley said Wednesday. The Iowa Republican believes the GOP's $1 trillion health, economic assistance, liability protection, and schools, or HEALS, Act charts a reasonable path forward to provide more help for Americans in the public health and economic crisis. At the same time, Grassley, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, acknowledged there's a big difference between the bill House Democrats approved and what Senate Republicans are proposing. So we're going to have to obviously put it to negotiations with our Democratic colleagues. The biggest point of contention will be whether to continue a $600 a week unemployment benefit or to reduce that to $200 per week for 2 months, before moving to 70% of a worker's pay, which is the GOP plan. The supplement is justified, Grassley said, because the unemployment is not the responsibility of those workers thrown out of their jobs because of COVID-19. However, with nearly two-thirds of those people earning more on unemployment than if they were working, the federal government has become an unfair competitor with businesses trying to bring employees back to work. The GOP plan is being criticized by left-leaning groups for not increasing food stamp benefits and housing assistance to help prevent evictions. Rather than propose a package commensurate with the scale of harm we are seeing, Sue Dinsdale, director of Iowa Citizens Action, said about the impact COVID-19 and unemployment are having on Iowans, Republicans in the Senate have proposed a package that does little to address growing hunger, unemployment, loss of health care coverage, and state and local budget shortfalls. The unemployment benefit, a second round of $1,200 stimulus payments, and returning to work will help address those issues. The GOP plan also includes funding for child care and changes the rules to allow state and local governments to use federal aid to offset revenue losses. At the same time, right-leaning groups are criticizing Congress, particularly Republicans, for spending too much. FreedomWorks, for example, said the COVID-19 relief packages have produced a budget deficit that as a percentage of GDP has not been seen since the end of World War II. Although there are some good parts in the latest proposal, it doesn't include a payroll tax holiday. Decoupling health savings accounts from high-deductible health plans and school choice, all FreedomWorks priorities. We're hearing from a lot of people who say the $3 trillion that we already put out there is too much, and where's the end of this, and all that sort of thing, Grassley said. Although there have been other pandemics, this is the first time the response has been to shut down the economy. So we have responsibility to get it opened up, Grassley said. Our next article is headlined, Deer Fire Causes Minor Damage. Firefighters spent hours battling a blaze that broke out at John Deere's northeast site Tuesday night. The fire started shortly after 9 p.m. with a filter in the ventilation system in the plant at 3828 Newell Street and spread to an air handling room on top of the main building, said Battalion Chief Bill Beck with Waterloo Fire Rescue. Beck said the high elevation made it difficult to move water to the fire's location, which also had high heat and thick smoke. The fire was under control in about 45 minutes, and firefighters remained on the scene until around 1:30 a.m. No injuries were reported. At the time of the fire, the building was closed for maintenance, and a contractor was on the scene. House 60 Hopeful corrects flyers that lack attribution, by Amy Rivers of the Courier from Cedar Falls. A candidate for the Iowa legislature confirmed several dozen campaign flyers were distributed in the Cedar Valley without the legal notification about who paid for them. Ryan Howard of Cedar Falls, a Republican running against Democratic incumbent Representative Dave Williams in House District 60, said his campaign distributed, quote, fewer than 100, unquote, of the flyers without an advertising attribution required on all political material by law. Iowa Code 68A.405 requires a paid-for-by attribution on most political material. The statement must include a name and address, according to the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board. Howard said the mistake was his. The state and local party has no oversight on candidate materials, said Leanne Saul, county party chairwoman. She noted candidates are given guidelines on how to put together campaign advertisements. Sometimes mistakes happen. Willful violations of the law may be subject to a fine, according to the Iowa Code. On Wednesday, Howard said the flyers were distributed to just a few neighborhoods in Cedar Falls, and everyone has received the updated notice. District 60 covers much of southwestern Blackhawk County, including parts of Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Hudson. Howard's campaign raised $200 between mid-May and mid-July, according to the last campaign disclosure report, and his total cash on hand was $100.59. This is a reminder. You're listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, July 30th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In our first obituary, Dennis R. Fulton, 1945 to 2020. Dennis R. Fulton, age 74 of Waukee, passed away Sunday night, July 26th, at the Cavanaugh Hospice House on 56th Street with his loving family at his side. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st, at the New Hope Christian Church in Marshalltown, with Pastor Kerry Jeck officiating. He will be laid to rest in Benson Cemetery at Whitton, with graveside rites conducted by Reverend Ralph Norman of the Liscum Church of Christ. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown, with a 7 p.m. Masonic service. A memorial fund is being established. For condolences, please visit www.mitchellfh.com. Born Dennis Richard Fulton on October 2, 1945, in Muscatine, Iowa, he was the son of Richard C. and Marjorie Paul Fulton. He grew up in Wilton Junction, Iowa. His family later moved to Whitton, and he graduated from the Union Whitton High School in 1963. He returned to his former area, graduating from the Muscatine Community College in 1965, after lettering in basketball and baseball. His uncle Harry, who owned the funeral home in Wilton, sparked something in Dennis to follow suit, and in 1967 he graduated from the University of Minnesota with a degree in mortuary science. Dennis marked 52 years in funeral service this year, after serving countless families at Estelle Perrins in Marshalltown, Dunn's Funeral Home in Des Moines, Turner's Funeral Home and Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids, and the Greer Funeral Home in Waterloo. He and Connie also started Code Mide Associates, an asset and recovery firm. On October 27, 1968, he was united in marriage to the love of his life, Connie Jo Morris. They made their home in many communities where he was active in church, the Masonic and Shrine, and the lives of his children. He held offices in Cedar Rapids Washington High Athletic Club and the Marian Christian Church, the Des Moines JCs, Elk Ayer Shrine, and was the youngest Reagan delegate at the Republican National Convention in 1980 in Detroit. Left to cherish his memory is Connie, his loving wife of nearly 52 years, daughter Michelle Quaker of Fairfield, son Derek Fulton of Waukee, two grandchildren, his siblings Steve Fulton of Whitton, Sonia Moore of Grant Conrad, Peg Clemens of Union, Ron Fulton of Windsor Heights, many nieces and nephews he treasured, and his Aunt Janice Berkhofer of Moscow, Iowa. In death, Dennis rejoins his parents and grandparents. Then, Guadalupe M. Rodriguez, 1945 to 2020. Guadalupe Moreno Rodriguez was born on May 24, 1945, in Isleta, Texas, the daughter of Crescencio and Elena Garcia Moreno. She was raised in Laredo, Texas, and graduated from St. Mary's High School. On November 6, 1973, Guadalupe was united in marriage to Primitivo Rodriguez. The couple made their home in Mexico before moving to Waterloo. She worked as a traveling CNA throughout Iowa and lived a glamorous life. Guadalupe died at the age of 75 on July 28, 2020, at her home, surrounded by family who loved her. She was preceded in death by her parents. Guadalupe is survived by her husband of 47 years, Primitivo. Her children, Gina Cortez of Waterloo, Pedro Manuel Rodriguez of Waterloo, Maria Elena Schneff of Waterloo, Benito Rodriguez, Alejandro Rodriguez of Marshalltown, Miguel Rodriguez of San Diego, and Giovanna Rodriguez of Waterloo, 13 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. The funeral for Guadalupe M. Rodriguez will be on Monday, August 3rd, 2020, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church at 10:30 a.m., with burial to follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Florine E. Clark, 1927 to 2020. Florine E. Clark, age 93, of Ionia, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, July 28, 2020, at Mercy One Medical Center in New Hampton, Iowa. A public graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31, 2020, at Boniface Catholic Cemetery in Ionia, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Boniface Catholic Cemetery and the Chickasaw County Conservation. Florine Elizabeth Kramer was born on January 5, 1927, to Anthony and Cecilia Gilbert Kramer in New Hampton, Iowa. She attended and graduated from St. Boniface Catholic School in Ionia, graduating in 1945. Flossie was united in marriage to Harold Clark in a double wedding with Norma Kramer and John Brumman, Jr. on July 9, 1949, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Ionia. The couple made their home near Bassett, Iowa, for 6 years, and then they moved to the present-day farm northwest of Ionia. Besides being a full-time mother, she worked numerous years at Wiglin's Tavern, Dave's Tap, and Ray's Tap as a cook, waitress, and bartender. Flossie enjoyed gardening and flower gardening, fishing, driving her golf cart to tour the farm, reading, and playing cards. She also enjoyed cooking and spending time with her family. Flossie was a member of St. Boniface Catholic Church and the Church Guild and St. Boniface Bingo. Flossie is survived by her children, Anthony Clark of Kendallville, Indiana, Catherine McLean of Ionia, Iowa, Timothy Clark of Charles City, Iowa, Daniel Clark of Ionia, Iowa, and Richard Clark of Ottumwa, Iowa, 11 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren, sisters Norma Brummond of Ionia, Iowa, and Patricia Balk of Charles City, Iowa, and sister-in-law Judith Kramer of Sugar Grove, Illinois. Flossie is preceded in death by her parents, Anthony and Cecilia Kramer, husband Harold on August 15, 1994, infant son John, sisters Lucinda Hansen and Lucille Burgart, and brother John Kramer. Benny K. Heiberger, 1930-2020. Benny Keith Heiberger, 89, of Janesville, Iowa, passed away January 25, 2020. Benny was born on November 27, 1930, in Des Moines, Iowa, the son of Frieda Bell Barton and Floyd F. Heiberger. She graduated from East High School in 1949 and served in the U.S. Army from 1951 until 1954. On May 20, 1951, Benny married Dolores Jean Marks in Waterloo. He worked for John Deere from 1959 until 1987. Dolores passed away in 2018. Benny is survived by a daughter, Linda Peterson of Newton, sons Kurt Heiberger of Harker Heights, Texas, Keith Heiberger of Cedar Falls, and Jeff Heiberger of Janesville, 12 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, a brother, James Stoll, and a sister, Joanne Hatfield. He was preceded in death by his wife, his parents, a grandson, Casey Heiberger, a granddaughter, Sarah Brandt, a daughter-in-law, Sheila Heiberger, two sisters, Mary Ellen Foley and Dolita Sams, and brother Clifford in infancy. Visitation will be on Thursday, July 30, 2020, from 4 to 7 p.m., at Kaiser Korsen Funeral Home in Waverly. Graveside services will be at 1 p.m. on Friday, July 31, at Oakland Cemetery, Janesville, with military rites provided by the Denver American Legion. A luncheon will follow at the Fraternal Order of Eagles, number 4074, Cedar Falls. Memorials for Benny Heiberger may be directed to his family for later designation. Marilyn Keegan, age 76, of Plainfield, Iowa, died Tuesday, July 28, 2020, at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 1, 2020, at the Bridge Church in Charles City, Iowa, with Reverend Bob Williams III celebrating the service. Interment will follow at Pleasant Valley Cemetery in rural Clarksville. Friends may greet the family from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 31, 2020, at Hugeback Johnston Funeral Home and Crematory, Olson Chapel in Nashua. Visitation continues an hour prior to the service on Saturday at the church in Charles City. Online condolences for Marilyn's family may be left at hugebackfuneralhome.com, 641-435-4134. Elizabeth A. Klein, 1939-2020. Elizabeth Betty Ann Klein, 81, of Iowa City, passed away Sunday, July 26, 2020, at Solon Care Center from COVID-19 following a long journey with Alzheimer's. A graveside service will be held at a later date at the Orange Township Cemetery in Waterloo, Iowa, with the date and time to be announced when decided. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to Compasses Hospice, Alzheimer's Association, or Solon Care Center. Betty was born June 27, 1939, in Waterloo, Iowa, to Thomas and Thelma Wood Saul. She grew up in Waterloo, graduating from West High School in 1957. She married the love of her life, Gary Klein, on February 1, 1958, in Waterloo. Together, they raised two daughters, Deborah and Lori, and enjoyed 62 memorable and loving years together. Betty and her husband eventually moved to Tipton, where they owned and operated AgriBuilders, which later became Custom Builders. Betty was Gary's right hand since starting their successful business in 1964. After they sold their business, they moved to Iowa City. The couple spent their winters in the Florida Keys, which they did for nearly 25 years, and traveled all over the country with their motorhome. Betty was a member of the United Methodist Church in Tipton before moving to Iowa City. She loved to entertain, was a wonderful cook, and made many beautiful quilts. Above all, Betty loved being a wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, and time spent with them meant everything to her. Betty is survived by her husband, Gary, of Iowa City, Iowa, her two daughters, Deborah Wiskus of Oviedo, Florida, and Lori Wood of North Liberty, four grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, two brothers, Dick Saul of Alamo, Texas, and Don Saul of Waterloo, Iowa, one sister, Bonnie McClary of Independence, Iowa, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her father and mother-in-law, Harold and Edna Klein, and one brother-in-law, Don Klein. The family would like to express their appreciation to the staff at Solon Care Center and Compasses Hospice Care for the love and care they provided to their beloved wife and mother. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.lensingfuneral.com. Donald E. Pegel, 1937-2020. From Sumner, Donald E. Pegel, 83, of rural Sumner, died Tuesday morning, July 28, 2020, in his home surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held 10 a.m. Saturday, August 1, 2020, at the United Methodist Church in Sumner, with Reverend Julie Ahrens officiating. Interment will follow at Union United Methodist Church Cemetery, rural Sumner. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday, July 31st at Becker Milne's Funeral Home in Sumner, and for 1 hour preceding services at the church Saturday. Memorials may be made to the family for later designation. Online condolences may be left at www.beckermilnesreddick.com. Due to the state and federal guidance on gatherings due to the COVID-19 pandemic, social distancing will be required. Those in attendance are encouraged to wear a mask. We encourage those who are feeling ill to stay home and contact the family with a card, a note on the web page, text, or a call. Donald Eugene, son of Walter and Phyllis Kohlmeyer Pagel, was born March 26, 1937, in rural Fayette County, Iowa. He was baptized and confirmed at the Union Evangelical United Brethren Church, rural Sumner. Don attended country school and graduated from Sumner High School in 1955. He was voted homecoming king. On December 11, 1960, he was united in marriage with Donna Henn at the Evangelical United Brethren Church in Sumner. The two of them were always seen together. His wife was his rock throughout his life. They would have celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary this December. To this union, 3 sons were born, Dan, Dennis, and Dean. Don was a lifetime farmer in the rural Sumner area in addition to grain farming. He raised cattle, farrowed hogs, and worked at John Deere & Company in Waterloo for 31 years, retiring in December 1991. Don was a lifetime active member of Union Methodist Church, rural Sumner, and Farm Bureau. He enjoyed hunting, deer and pheasant, and playing 500. He was involved in a couple of hard clubs. One of Don's greatest joys was imparting his wisdom of farming to his grandson, Trevor. Don's grandchildren meant the world to him. He always wanted what was best for every one of his family members. Even if we knew how to do various tasks, he would always tell us how to do it his way, quote, the right way. Don is survived by his wife Donna of Sumner, 3 children, Dan Pagel of Sumner, Dennis Pagel of New Hampton, and Dean Pagel of Sumner, 3 grandchildren, 1 great-grandchild on the way, 2 brothers, Albert and Roger Pagel, both of Sumner, and many nieces and nephews. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his 4 brothers, Lyle, Dwayne, Russell, and August Pagel. Phyllis L. Green, 1928-2020. Phyllis Lydia Green of Cedar Falls died Tuesday, July 28, 2020, at Western Home Communities, Cedar Falls. A private burial will be at Postville Cemetery. Phyllis was born August 16, 1928, in Decorah, Iowa, to William and Hilda Foltz Erickson. She married Kenneth Theodore, or K. Ted Green, August 22, 1948, in Decorah. Ted and Phyllis made their homes in Olin, Postville, and Eldridge, returning to Decorah in retirement. He preceded her in death May 28, 2009. Phyllis grew up on a farm during the Depression and always appreciated her simple childhood in rural Burr Oak. She graduated from Decorah High School in 1946 with a high school normal training certificate. Her teaching career began in one-room school. She taught at Claremont for 2 years and at North Scott Schools in Eldridge and Long Grove for 25 years. During that time, she completed a master's degree in counseling at University of Iowa. She retired in 1993 and served as a substitute teacher for the next 20 years. Her family will continue to cherish memories of Cousins Camp and other family gatherings at Maplewood, the Green Family Heritage Farm near Castalia. She wrote stories about her childhood, poetry inspired by memories and insights, stories and moral lessons in the Itchy Creek series, and in the last 5 years, hundreds of letters to her families and friends. She will be remembered for love of her family, dedication to creative teaching, passion for travel, and enthusiasm for family gatherings. Those left to honor her memory include her children, Bill Green of Oshin, Fred and Robin Green of Minnetrista, Minnesota, Joe and Trina Green of Lena, Illinois, Pat and Lewis Beck of Buckingham, and daughter-in-law Chris Green of Long Grove. There are 12 grandchildren and 24 great-grandchildren. In addition to her husband, Phyllis L. Green was preceded in death by her parents, sister Marcella Fitch, and son James Green. Memorials may be directed to Camp Courageous, Box 418, Monticello, Iowa, 52310, or to a charity that is meaningful to you. And now I'll turn to the commentary page and read the editorial of the courier that was originally appeared in the Fort Dodge Messenger on July 25th and reprinted here for us. Headlined, Stop the Attack Ads Already. It would be hard for anyone to forget that a national election is about 5 months away. The continuous stream of advertising, much of it negative, is enough to prevent any Iowan from forgetting about the upcoming vote. The fact that the candidates and their various supporters are advertising a lot isn't a bad thing. In fact, it's a necessary part of a democracy. It's the nature and content of so much of that promotional material that is the problem. Rather than hearing about the ideas of the various candidates, people are being subjected to an onslaught of mudslinging, attacks, and character assassinations, and quite frankly, they are sick of it. The constant negativity is likely causing people to tune it all out and quit paying attention to the election. That's bad for our democracy. We challenge candidates at all levels to stop it. Candidates ought to be telling us their ideas for the future of our community, state, and nation, rather than trying to tear each other down. And they should be telling us why their qualifications and their track records make them the best choice, instead of trying to dig up dirt on their opponents. The mudslinging isn't limited to one political party, and it appears that some of the worst garbage voters are being subjected to comes not from political parties or individual campaigns, but from various committees and groups that support candidates. The candidates should be telling those groups to clean up their acts. We believe candidates should run on their ideas and their records. To do anything else is an insult to the people whose votes they are trying to win. This is the editorial reprinted from the Fort Dodge Messenger from July 25th by the Waterloo Courier Editorial Board. This editorial board includes David Adams, General Manager, Jackie Smith, North Iowa Editor, and Douglas Hines, News Editor. Here's a story from the sports section of the paper. Headline, Down Swinging. Number 1 Johnston tops Cedar Falls at state baseball tournament. Fight was never a question. Cedar Falls baseball team went down swinging Wednesday during the program's first state baseball tournament appearance in 31 years and first trip to Des Moines' Principal Park. The Tigers out-hit number 1 seed Johnston 11-9. Cedar Falls, however, was unable to come up with a lockdown inning on defense. Johnston scored in each inning, taking advantage of 9 walks and 4 hit batters during an 11-7 victory in the quarterfinal rounds of the Class 4A playoffs. The Dragons' leadoff hitter reached base in 5 of the 6 innings, with that runner coming around to score in each occasion. Johnston is so disciplined at the plate, Cedar Falls coach Brett Williams said, after 5 different Tigers towed the mound. They made us throw strikes, and we weren't throwing our off-speed for strikes, so they could sit on fastballs. A Cedar Falls team 7-2, shy on games in this COVID-19 pandemic altered season, rallied from down 6-0 after three innings. The Tigers cut the deficit to 7-6 when a pair of runs scored on a double play, followed by an errant throw with the bases loaded in the fifth inning. Top-ranked Johnston, 23-3, remained undeterred. The Dragons immediately answered with three runs in the bottom of the ninth and maintained that cushion to reach the semifinals in the program's fifth consecutive trip to state. Parker Sharp's RBI double served as the big blow as part of his 2-for-3 game. Johnston leadoff hitter Ben Wilms finished 3-for-3 with a walk, two runs scored, and two RBIs. "We didn't really know a ton about them," Johnston coach Michael Barta said, addressing the unconventional matchup against a Cedar Falls team that had only played 8 games prior to state. "We knew that we had to play well 1-9 in our lineup, and we did that. I was impressed with them," Cedar Falls, battling at the plate, fouling some tough pitches off, and they had double-digit hits. "I think their coaches do a wonderful job, and they deserve to be here." The Tigers' offense was ignited from an unlikely source. Junior Connor Woods secured his first at-bats since the second week of the season against Waterloo East. Woods' first hit of the summer came when he pulled a second-inning single to left. He followed that with a three-run double to deep left field in the fourth inning as part of a 3-for-4 game at the plate. "It meant a lot," Woods said, addressing his opportunity. "I had to step up and do my part. As soon as I got my spot, I knew I'd perform. It just shows that our hard work finally paying off." Williams knew the work Woods and so many others had invested since last season to get an opportunity like they found Wednesday. "It was just one of those years when every kid mattered," the first-year Cedar Falls head coach said. "We wanted every kid to contribute, and they did. What a fun atmosphere to do this in, and our guys competed." Cedar Falls junior Brody Bartlett added a two-hit game and finished with three runs scored. Sophomore shortstop Caleb Raisty recorded a pair of hits with a run, while Max Steinlage, Gage Flanscha, Drew Hoth, and Zach Neese also reached the hit column against Johnston's talented quartet of pitchers. "We didn't panic against a great team," Williams said. "We knew coming in that it was going to be a dogfight. We did show early that we were a little nervous, and we came back, and the guys, they battled. They really did battle, and I'm so proud of those guys for doing that." Nearly every player who stepped onto the field for Cedar Falls will return next summer, including all 11 hits from Wednesday's game. We've got to ramp it up because we want to play on Saturday night for a state championship," Williams said. "That's our goal. We bring back some guys that can really get us there. We just have to grow and get better. We really worked on changing the energy and culture early on. Every time we broke down to take the field, it was family. We saw so many of our youth players here today, and we want to change that culture and get here like Johnston. They're here every year. We want to be that." A summer of baseball in 2020 only meant 9 games for Cedar Falls. Still, Woods and company are as determined as ever to embrace the grind in preparation for 2021. "It starts tomorrow," Woods said. "It's exciting." And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I'm your reader, Dan Shear. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. By the way, if you missed or had trouble writing down the phone numbers or website URLs read today, this is an easy way to go back and review them. That's iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening today.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.